was supposed to be seamless trading post-Brexit, but it doesn't seem to be working, and the developments of the past few days are a testament. The Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed upon by the UK and EU to avoid trade problems, has become a problem itself. Now the UK is threatening to unilaterally suspend it.
Article 16 says that this article can be triggered unilaterally by either side if there's some aspect of the treaty which is causing unforeseen social, economic or environmental problems. But there's nothing about the way that the Northern Ireland Protocol is operating now which is unforeseen. It has led de facto to a border between the six counties of the north of Ireland and Britain.
The warning came from Brexit Minister Lord Frost, only days after the leader of Northern Ireland's pro-UK ruling party warned of a new era of violence and instability if the protocol collapsed.
That our political institutions will not survive a failure.
The UK has been pushing for a renegotiation of the protocol, despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising during Brexit negotiations that it wouldn't impact the flow of goods to and from Northern Ireland.
There will not be checks on goods going from Northern Ireland to Great Britain, because we're the government of the United Kingdom and we will not institute.
A promise Boris Johnson hasn't been able to keep. Instead, he's announced grace periods since January last year to delay the agreement's full implementation. Meanwhile, the European Union, who threatened legal action but are yet to take it, say the UK made its bed and has to lie in it.
They want to have their cake and eat it. They want both to be able to satisfy their own workers at home and have a smash the red wall, claim to be in favour of Brexit, claim to be in favour of British workers, and at the same time be inside the European club.
The agreement was forged to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Republic of Ireland, and to protect the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. The two sides agreed that goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK had to be checked according to EU rules. That didn't sit well with the pro-UK unionists.
The Northern Ireland Protocol is underpinned by international law. Any violation of it will dent international trust in the government here. And the whole escalating row over the protocol is yet another episode in the ongoing Brexit saga, rekindling questions about whether or not the UK's divorce from the single market was a good idea after all. Saeed Purizza, London.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. And we're bringing post-Brexit issues in the spotlight. Now, to discuss that, I'll be joined by senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, in New York. And journalist and political commentator, James Tuohy, in Plymouth.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to have you both, gentlemen. Welcome to the show. Now let's go to Ian. Given the circumstances, Ian, do you foresee a fresh crisis over the withdrawal agreement and arrangements for Northern Ireland?
Foreseeing is a good word, because we're talking about the unforeseeable, allegedly. The sad bit is, as your commentary alluded, everything here was entirely foreseeable. It was foreseen, it was predicted. For everybody except Boris Johnson, who was in defiance of reality. I mean, they've painted themselves to so many corners. They've almost got a supply of tartan paint. There's so many different coloured stripes. First of all, the Northern Irish unionists voted for Brexit, but not for the border. They didn't want the border with Ireland. Secondly, the British Conservative Party, which used to be called the Conservative and Unionist Party, founded on the bedrock principle that Ireland was part of Britain, basically threw away Northern Ireland in return for getting Brexit on its home patch. And then Brexit itself, these trade restrictions, and it's not as though they're bad things. I think most of us in Britain don't realize how lucky we are to live by European health and food standards as opposed to American ones. And part of the plot here, I think, is that Boris Johnson and his cronies have consistently wanted to throw away European Union regulations and introduce much laxer American regulations so that they can import chicken bathing chlorine from America, from beef laden with hormones from Australia. They want to do all of these things because they want to make money, and also because it shows the independence. It shows just how independent Britain is. And what the last few weeks have shown is just how dependent Britain is on its major trading partner in the European Union. I really can't see any way out of it. They're going to negotiate. There's going to be ugly car crashes. There's going to be staring each other in the face. There's going to be bellowing and bickering and sniping as well, in that you'll find container loads of sausages on their way to Northern Ireland being impounded. And the latest one is COVID, where perfectly legal accepted COVID vaccines have to get export and import permissions both sides, even though 6 months ago they didn't have to do that. This is the type of restriction that is just going to keep on unfolding. It's the gift that Brexit keeps on giving. And you either walk Brexit back, or you live with it and wallow in the consequences of empty supermarket shelves, fields with no agricultural workers, truck drivers who aren't there, and the trucks aren't. I think the Bank of England today did it say £440 million a week foregone in growth as a result of Brexit. And this is the Bank of England, which is the Conservative sort of home, back pocket economic consultant. It is an unmitigated disaster, and it will carry on being an unmitigated disaster. And that's entirely foreseeable.
Now, James, massive problems have been created for Britain's Northern Ireland by imposing checks on transit of goods with EU member Ireland. The UK has so far voluntarily, kept the checks suspended. So is renegotiation the solution to the problem?
Well, renegotiation is written into Article 16, which is what Lord Frost is talking about invoking. If you read the details of the Northern Ireland Protocol, it says that Article 16, yes, either side can invoke it, but it's not really unilateral, like your reporter said. They have to give a one-month notification to the other party, the UK to the EU or vice versa, and then you start negotiating straight away, and the measures have to be limited to dealing with the problem at hand, and they have to be temporary, and the negotiations are all about finding a way to end, putting an end point on those measures. So it's not apocalypse, it's not they're not tearing up the treaty. They're not tearing up the Northern Ireland Protocol here. So, the problem has been, it's mainly to do with, there's a few things, but largely it's to do with chilled meats, that's ready-made meat products, which are, for the supermarket shelf, that are going over there. And the effect has been essentially that Irish producers, which export to Britain anyway, have kind of cleaned up, and they've got a monopoly. They're supplying everybody up in Northern Ireland. So, and British suppliers want to do it. But there's other things. Obviously, the political situation there in Northern Ireland, in the DUP is it's caused a crisis in the DUP, where they've actually gone through two leaders in a few months. And the new leader is taking a very hard line, because that reflects how unionists feel about this. And let's say Sinn Féin, the main Republican Party, has a belief that enough unionists want to stay in the EU that much from stemming from the result of the Brexit referendum up there, that they'll turn around and they'll say, okay, well, you know, maybe we'll vote to actually reunify with the Republic of Ireland. That's not going to happen. Okay, don't get into that. Is that, you know, ultimately, I think this is going to go on. It's a kind of negotiating thing. A lot of the language that's being used is very dramatic, but it's basically just a negotiating position. And perhaps the way out of it is going to be some kind of deal between Britain and the EU, which covers agricultural products, including fresh meat, that gets you out of it. And it doesn't become, it'll no longer be an issue. So, yeah.
Okay. Now, Ian, as regards the renegotiation, the European Commission says that this will lead to even further instability for both people and businesses. Do you share the same view?
Well, you know, the thing about negotiations is they're usually about solid, concrete things. You know, you weigh your Irish pound of sausages against the Danish bacon coming in the other way, and you know, you produce some type of equivalence. But here we've got nationalism and wounded feelings. We have the Northern Ireland unionists who wanted to be part of Britain, who voted for Britain to come out for Brexit with the out of the European Union, with the direct consequence that it attenuates the links, that it stretches the links in Ireland, which they don't want, because they don't want a border, amazingly enough, between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. They want it open for a commercial consequence. So there's this continuous interface between commercial and rational negotiation and the nationalism. And it's not just on the Northern Irish side. I mean, the whole thing about Brexit is people, I think we underestimate this, people who voted for Brexit are quite prepared to suffer empty supermarket shelves, lack of fresh fruit, the fact that they can't get builders and truck drivers, because it satisfies their nationalist feelings, their xenophobic feelings, because at least we haven't got Romanians picking the blackberries, you know, at least we haven't got Poles doing the plumbing. We can wait a bit longer to get the toilet fixed, but we haven't got any Poles here, and that's what really matters. I mean, I think we've, like in 1840, we've underestimated the extent to which xenophobia and nationalism and pride plays a part in this, and we're seeing that with the Northern Irish. I mean, hey, nobody knows about irrational prejudice like the Northern Irish.
Okay, James can't wait to give a reaction to what you said. James, go ahead.
Well, firstly, I mean, I haven't seen any empty supermarket shelves. The supermarkets here have stopped down here in Plymouth. And, you know, when you see photos of that, you often see in the background the other shelves, the one shelf is empty and the other shelves are full. We had an electrician in a few weeks ago. He's Polish. He's staying here because actually about 5 million people asked from the EU have applied for long-term residency and got it. There's a huge amount of building work going on around here. I've got two houses that I can see out of my window, there's a whole housing estate where they're changing the rooms, and there's a couple of private houses where they're doing it. And every day up on the street, I see a lorry coming from a company that, one of about five different companies that I've seen that are training lorry drivers, because the wages for lorry drivers have suddenly jumped up. This is a bit of a labour shortage, and that labour shortage is not just in the UK, it's all over Europe and most of the world, actually. And it's probably more to do with the lockdown than anything, the COVID-19 lockdown. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of problems with that. You know, there isn't a hard border. There wasn't a hard border between the UK and Ireland before the EU even existed, and there isn't now. There is a unilateral agreement that's about 100 years old called the Common Travel Area, which means that every citizen of the UK and every citizen of Ireland can travel freely between the two without even a passport and live indefinitely without a visa and work and they get full voting rights. It's actually much better than the rights, you know, the non-rights that you get in your so-called freedom of movement within the EU, because I lived in Spain for 5 years, and I had very limited rights. I did not have the rights of a Spanish person. So, but an Irish person living in the UK or a British person living in Ireland has full citizens' rights. And there's also a free trade agreement between the UK and the EU, which the Northern Ireland Protocol is part of. So there is actually no great impediment of moving goods across the border. And this is the stuff, this is the issue that was supposed to make the Northern Ireland Protocol imperative, because out of an argument that it would breach the border checks between Northern Ireland and the Republic would breach the Good Friday Agreement. I don't think they would, to be honest. I think there is a great deal of freer movement across that border than there is between most sovereign states.
All right. Now, Ian, London says it had no choice other than delaying the post-Brexit trade controls, and that's because of global pressure on supply chains. Is the UK in the right?
Global pressure on supply chains. It sounds almost like the type of shortages we're just saying weren't happening. Now, there is a global pressure on supply chains, and it's particularly acute on the entirely foreseeable sort of narrow links, like across the channel, where the Conservative government seems to be amazed the cross-channel traffic goes through the channel ports. The Conservatives were amazed at this. They're so far away from reality most of the time. Similarly, they don't really know what's happening in between Northern Ireland and the mainland. Between the Great British mainland. They had no idea of the route this stuff took. They were negotiating in blind insouciance because of their nationalism. They really do not have the facts at their fingertips. And that's what they're continuing to prove that. There are repercussions on this. Don't underestimate them. I mean, there are the nationalists in Northern and Southern Ireland are sort of thinking, maybe the time to call for the referendum that was in the Good Friday Agreement. Because one of the things is that as soon as there's a prospect of a majority wanting unification of Ireland, in Northern Ireland, they're supposed to be calling the referendum. It hasn't happened yet, but somebody's waiting to trigger it, and we can be sure that if the current government in London carries on with its willful disregard of everybody else's opinions, they're likely to precipitate it, just like they're on the way to precipitating Scottish independence, even as they officially fight against it. They are incredibly incompetent. That's the top and bottom of it. They came out of Brexit with no clear plan because, as I've said before here, Boris Johnson not only didn't want Brexit, he thought he was going to lose. This was an internal weapon for him to win the Tory leadership. And when it won, he didn't know what to do with it. They had no ground plan. They didn't have any foresight. They didn't have a white paper saying, well, in that case, this is what we must do. They've had to make it up on the hoof as they've gone along, and their hooves are cloven in every sense. It's diabolical what they've done. On almost every turn, they've been wrong-footed by the EU. And after being insulted by these people for decades, the bureaucrats in Brussels are saying, well, up yours. We don't care. We don't really see any reason to bend over backwards to accommodate. We've got a London government that's basically said, we're prepared to rip up agreements in international law because it's inconvenient. We don't have to talk to you about it. So their reaction is, go ahead. You know, they don't really care whose sausages get into Northern Ireland. It's not a big issue, but it is for the voters in Britain. And the British press and the British government persists in thinking that we're talking about equal partners here. Britain is a very minor part of Europe, and it's made itself even more minor. It's made itself even more ineffectual by pulling out. It has far more weight inside than it does as a negotiating partner outside. At least inside, it had the benefits of an implicit veto. Outside, all it's got is I'll stamp my feet and I'll scream and I'll scream if you don't give me what I want. And they say, go, scream, stamp your feet, see if we care.
Interesting. Now, James, there's some who are arguing that UK's postponing the trade controls would give European firm exporters a commercial advantage over British firms. Is that true?
Sorry, I don't really understand that argument. Can you elaborate on that?
The question is that there are some people who say that postponing the trade controls would give European exporters a commercial edge over British firms.
Well, I don't know about that, because, I mean, the whole point is that they're trying to, put a stop to this, and, they're delaying, they're kicking the can down the road to allow British firms to keep, shipping goods to Northern Ireland under the same terms that they had before, you see, under the same conditions that they had before. The advantage, the advantage was largely that I can see is that Irish chilled meats producers kind of got a monopoly on the Northern Ireland market for a while, and they still have that advantage. You see, I don't see how that happens. I mean, what you get actually is a lot that trade associations do say a lot of things that don't actually make sense. Like the Hauliers Association here was saying that people were going to start death or something in Britain because there weren't enough lorry drivers, and that everyone's training to be a lorry driver now. But what they were really complaining about was that they had to put up wages. You see. The Confederation of British Industry has some plan, has some suggestion that it wants a kind of common veterinary agreement between the UK and the EU, so that there's no question of transmitting animal diseases like foot and mouth, for instance, and so forth, and these are all produced to the same standard. So, which would eliminate the issue at the heart of this, and there wouldn't be any. Wouldn't be any problems with the control. I don't see how it would give them an advantage. I mean, also, what have we done? I mean, we have most goods are essentially able to move freely between the UK and the EU anyway at this point, so what's changing? See, I'd like to address that. I mean, the thing about the political situation, I'd like to come back to that briefly, in Northern Ireland. This has become a very touchstone issue there, and it's polarised people, and what I think it's probably done is it's persuaded all those unionists who did quite a lot of them voted against leaving the EU. It's driven them very firmly back into the unionist camp. You know, it's a question now between Brexit and being part of reunification with the Republic. And for them, it's okay, they're going to choose Brexit, they're going to choose staying in the UK and Brexit. So I think it's probably entrenched the position, and, for the Republicans who want to, who are seeking a referendum, a border poll, as they say, on reunification, I think they're in stalemate, basically. With that, so there's no movement on that. There's going to be no movement there. But I think ultimately there will be, there has to be negotiation, because every time you press the Article 16 button, it triggers a series of negotiations, and there will be an outcome. And also, I'd say just one thing. I mean, what you said there about not knowing what they were doing. They knew what they were doing. Boris Johnson, he's guilty of mis-selling the Northern Ireland Protocol and the whole post-Brexit trade agreement.
Okay, James, sorry, I got to jump in. We are out of time. I'm very sorry for jumping in.
Okay.
I want to thank our guests. We had senior analysts with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams in New York, and journalist and political commentator James Tweedy, who joined us from Plymouth. And that's it for this edition of The Spotlight. I've been your host, Behrouz Najaf.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim.
does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din
al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Let's focus on the laws of Homs. According to the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Sheikh Javid, we are working on, we're talking about laws according to Ayatollah Sistani according to Ayatollah Khamenei, on Homs. Let me ask you this question. Some people take the responsibility to pay for the electricity and water bills or any kind of bills for some Sayyids. Is it permissible to include that kind of payment in the annual Homs account?
Of course, first of all, I should explain that according to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, if a person wants to spend Sahmi Imam or Sahmi Sadat, he needs his mujtahid's prior permission. He has to get his permission in order to take any action with regard to the Khums amount, whether it's the portion of Sayyids or the portion of Imams. He has to obtain his mujtahid's permission. But when it comes to electricity or water bills, again, it's because he wants to include it as his Sahmi Sadat, for example.
Mm-hmm.
He should again get his mujtahid's permission. Now, when it comes to the past, when it, for example, if someone has, because of not knowing that he has to get his permission, done this, and at the end, he wants to consider it as khums, the money he has paid towards the electricity bills or water, gas bills, he, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, it is sufficient and it can count as his khums.
Yes.
For the Sahmi Sadat, of course. But if he wants to continue the same in the following months, of course he has to get his mujtahid's permission for doing this.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. I'd appreciate it and would be very much grateful if you could explain about this situation. Does a Sayyid who has a decent job and earns for himself, all right, or herself, have the right to take khums or not?
Hmm. Well, a person with a regular source of income, okay, is not considered to be poor. A poor person is a person who does not have means of livelihood, who does not have a regular source of income. If a person has a permanent job, a stable job, with a decent, let's say, with a handsome amount of salary, he is not considered to be poor because he has a regular source of income. He can support his family with that income, and he can manage his family expenses with the income which he receives and which is guaranteed, of course, because he is, for example, a government employee, or he's a government officer working for the government, having his regular source of income, so he is not considered to be poor.
Mm-hmm.
A poor person, unlike an indigent person, because we have miskeen and faqir, a poor person is a person who does not have any means of livelihood for one year. For example, you have it for this month, but you do not have it for the next month. And so you are a poor person.
Uh-huh.
And if you do not have a job or something, then you deserve to receive money. But a miskin or an indigent person is someone who does not have the expenses for one day, okay? So he is more entitled. He deserves to receive the khums or the two portions of khums.
I see. So if there's a preference, you should have to give it to an indigent person.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Is khums payable on a mukhammas money?
We discussed this issue, of course, in one of the previous episodes. Of course, people generally, there are many people who think that, okay, the mukhammas money, because it remains unused for over a year, again, they have to pay khums from it. Of course, this is a misconception on the part of many people. Mukhammas money is not entitled, is not liable for khums. And no matter how many years pass over the mukhammas amount, khums does not have to be paid from the mukhammas money. Now, this is an Arabic word. And Muhammad's money means the money from which Khums has been paid in the previous year or previous years. Mm-hmm. Okay, like for example, if you had $10,000 and you paid $2,000 of it as Khums, now there are, you have $8,000. Okay, in the coming year you are going to have again $10,000. So you are not going to pay Khums from the $10,000. You are going to pay Khums from the $2,000 only.
Yes.
So you will have to pay only $400 as Khums. Not, let's say, again $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the point. And we have to differentiate between Muhammad's and non-Muhammad's money.
I see.
Khums is not paid on the money from which Khums had been paid in the previous years.
Okay.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
So, Sheikh Javid, does one have to pay Khums on even a shroud bought but remained unused for several years? Or is it sufficient to pay Khums on its purchase price only?
Okay. Of course, if Khums had been paid from the money which you used to buy the shroud.
Yes.
Khums is not payable on the shroud, nor is it payable on the principal amount which you used to buy the shroud, of course, because you paid Khums in the first place, and you are not supposed to pay Khums again from the same money, okay? Because that was Muhammad's. You used the Muhammad's amount to buy the shroud. And now the shroud is purified in terms of khums and zakat, and you are not going to pay khums from it. But obviously, if you did not pay khums from the money, and now a year has passed, and you want to know whether khums has to be paid from the shroud or not,
mm-hmm.
of course, according to all religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, you have to pay khums from the shroud Or otherwise, you have to pay khums from the principal amount which you paid, which you used to buy the shroud.
Mm, I see.
And maybe the same rule applies. Of course, the same rule applies to a grave, for example.
Yes.
The grave, you have bought a piece of land to use it as a graveyard. Let's say there are families who have a family graveyard.
Yes.
Okay, and that piece of land has a year or maybe many years have passed over the
yes.
that piece of land which
before those people died.
Yeah, and which you are going to use for as a graveyard. Of course, you have to pay khums from that piece of land because that piece of land has a market value. You are going to if a year has passed on the plot or on the piece of land or on the grave, you have to pay khums from that grave.
But you have to pay it, in fact, according to the purchase price.
According to the purchase, because according
to Ayatollah
Khamenei,
yes.
of course, he says that if you pay khums from the purchase price, that is sufficient. That is sufficient. And of course, anything that you buy, just as we discussed in one of the previous episodes, if you buy a piece of land or anything, okay, and you remember how much you bought it for. For example, you spend a fixed amount of money to buy a piece of land or a house, and that house has never been used or within a year. You have to, if you pay khums from the purchase price, it is sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, there is a difference of opinion between Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Khamenei. Ayatollah
mm-hmm.
Sistani is of the view that khums should be paid from the current value of the property. But Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that khums is not necessary to be paid on the current value of the property. Khums should be paid from the principal
mm-hmm.
amount.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh.
Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Kuriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip demonstrated in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing inside Israeli prisons and the escapees from the Gilboa Maximum Security Prison. They called for the immediate release of all Palestinian prisoners, especially women and children. During a press conference in front of the Red Cross office, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas conditioned any future prisoner exchange with the regime on the release of the Gilboa escapees.
Our prisoners, including the six escapees, will be freed soon, despite all Zionist leaders' attempts to keep them behind bars. God willing, the six inmates will be on the top of the list of any prisoner swap deal. Those serving multiple life sentences and all female prisoners, as well as sick prisoners, will be freed in any future prisoner swap deal.
The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Palestinian prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture, harassment, and repression. Prisoners' advocacy groups accused the Israeli regime of increasing the ill-treatment of Palestinian prisoners following last week's historic escape of the six prisoners.
Following the heroic escape from the Gilbo prison, the Israeli prison service began fierce oppressive campaigns against all Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. It has transferred scores of prisoners to other jails and isolated dozens of them. The campaigns by the Israeli prison service include strip searching and torturing the prisoners. Some prisoners have sustained serious injuries.
A former prisoner who was released during the 2011 prisoner swap deal with the Israeli regime told Press TV, Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the 4th Geneva Convention.
Sick prisoners with chronic diseases are in critical condition due to medical negligence by the Israeli regime. Some 230 prisoners have lost their lives inside Israeli jails since 1967 because of medical negligence. Israel is an illegitimate and inhumane regime, and its prison service continues to violate all international laws and norms, mainly in the 4th Geneva Convention regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Experts say that the protection Israel enjoys from Western countries, mainly the United States, gives it the green light to further violate the rights of Palestinians. People here consider Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters. Securing their release is a highly emotive issue for all Palestinians. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors opens a weekly session just the day after IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi's trip to Tehran. Grossi had raised concerns about IAEA access to monitoring equipment in Iran and safeguards-related questions about the country's past nuclear activities. Rafael Grossi said no one could expect him to resolve the outstanding safeguards-related issues with Iran within a 10-hour visit to the country. The most urgent matter, however, the imminent loss of IAEA data, had been adequately addressed. The IAEA's surveillance cameras will now continue to record data that will be kept in Iran under joint seals. But for how long? Apparently, as long as it takes for talks to revive the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA to bear fruit.
You may have seen that this issue of the length has not been addressed. And the fact is that we, having discussed this, we agreed that it is better and more practical to go about it as developments evolve. It is a breach to give us some monitoring and verification capacity until there is something hopefully better.
Grossi said he would soon travel back to Iran to have a clear conversation with the new Iranian government, which in his words has very firm ideas with regards to nuclear activities. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA says all of the country's nuclear activities, including enrichment at the 20 and 60% levels and the production of uranium metal, are within Iran's rights under the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and in line with the country's safeguards commitments. Kazem Gharibabadi says since the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions against Iran are still in place and the other sides have not lived up to their commitments under the nuclear deal to remove them, nobody can demand that Iran stop these activities. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said on Monday that the first Iranian fuel shipment has reached the Banias port in Syria and will be transported by land to Lebanon this week.
The transport of fuel from Syria to the Bekaa begins Thursday, and it will be stored in specific tanks, and a second ship will arrive in Banias within a few days. The third ship, which I have mentioned before, is being prepared. All managerial prerequisites have been accomplished, so the vessel will be ready to sail. We're also preparing the logistics for the fourth shipment. About a month later, we'll see if we need a fifth or sixth ship. I have to clarify that we don't seek any gains on this fuel. We prefer all Lebanese and everyone who lives in Lebanon.
In his Talvi speech, Sayyid Nasrallah noted that Hezbollah will offer a one-month fuel donation to state-run hospitals, nursing homes, orphanages, disability centers, state-run water institutions, municipalities that have water wells, the civil defense, and the Lebanese Red Cross. Experts believe the speech highlights a roadmap Hezbollah has put forth to alleviate the fuel crisis the Lebanese people are dealing with, in light of the government's inactivity, and at the same time, challenges pressures imposed by the West against the nation.
Hezbollah's decision to bring in fuel and even warn the enemies that it will be considered Lebanese assets and that any strike on the ships will lead to retaliation was a very influential issue. It dealt a blow to the U.S. sanctions, whether against Iran, Syria, or Lebanon. The fact that the ship has reached its destination safely and has unloaded its cargo is in itself a victory.
The Hezbollah chief stressed that the resistance's deterrence power kept the ship safe. He said once the shipment reaches its destination, the fuel will be distributed carefully to prevent any potential profit seekers from taking advantage. Lebanon has been sleeping in the dark for many nights. Sayyid Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah's initiative to bring in fuel to Lebanon from Iran will not only bring electricity, but will also break the current U.S. sanctions against the country. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's fully indigenous Sahand frigate and Macron floating base are back in the Persian Gulf after more than 4 months of sailing that took them as far as the northern end of the Atlantic Ocean, over a distance of 44,000 kilometers. The naval crew were warmly welcomed by senior military officials who feel proud that Iran's navy is now capable of sailing in the high sea for extended periods.
We passed through three oceans, the Indian Ocean, the South Atlantic, and North Atlantic Ocean. On the way, we passed through rough seas and finally arrived in Russia's St. Petersburg port. We then sailed all the way back home. All the mission took us some 4.5 months. This is the farthest point we have ever sailed to.
Sahand Frigate is a radar-evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. And Macron Floating Base is a support vessel that's fitted with a large helicopter pad. Sahand and Macron departed from the Persian Gulf in early May. The two ships passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and sailed through the North Atlantic Ocean to reach Russia, all without docking for refueling on the way.
Throughout our journey, we did not stop to refuel or recharge our medical or food supplies. We went straight to our destination. We had our support vessel Macron along with Sahand that refueled it along the way. It sends a strong message to our enemies, especially the U.S., which tried to play down our naval might.
Iran's defense sector has been under 4 decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes. Iranian officials say they have viewed the sanctions as an opportunity to gain self-sufficiency in the industry. Iran now claims that it has indigenized more than 80% of its arsenal, from drones and helicopters to warships and submarines.
The Iranian Navy is back from the longest voyage in its history. To Iran, sailing through the Atlantic Ocean was a game changer for 2 reasons. First, it shows that the country can rely on its domestically built equipment for tough naval missions amid U.S. arms embargoes. And most importantly, it adds Iran to the short list of countries with a blue water navy. Yusuf Jalali from the Persian Gulf.
Abu Ubaida, spokesman for the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, pledged in a speech to release the prisoners who were rearrested after escaping from an Israeli jail on Monday. He also stressed that the rearrest of the prisoners does not hide the extent of shame Israel is going through, as Palestinian inmates have shaken their security system reputation.
No prisoner swap deal will be made without the release of our heroic prisoners who were rearrested by the occupation forces. We promise our inmates that they will be liberated soon within the no swap deal. Our inmates have exposed the fragility of the security of the enemy.
Immediately after Abu Ubaida's speech, Palestinian resistance fired rockets toward the occupied lands to show that they are ready to face the Israeli regime and defend Palestinians. In response, the Israeli airplane launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip.
The Palestinian resistance has achieved many goals. First, it succeeded in forcing the Israeli regime out of Gaza. Second, it demolished the Zionist thought of having this land for themselves. Israeli violations and attacks against Palestinians will never terrify us.
In conjunction with this, the resistance factions held a national conference stressing the importance of the resistance.
The clashes with this Israeli regime will persist. The regime can never feel secure as long as it steals our rights and kills our people. We will never leave our prisoners alone, and the resistance will set them free.
On Saturday evening, the rearrested prisoners appeared at the Israeli court in the city of Nazareth to extend their detention while being deprived of having a lawyer. Palestinians here stress on supporting the Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and considering them the symbol of the Palestinian issue. Palestinian factions believe that the resistance is the only way to get their rights back. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Yemen's armed forces, backed by local tribes, have successfully conducted the third phase of Operation Nasr al-Mubin. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, said Mahliya and the Rahaba directorates of Marib, with an area of 1,200 square kilometers, were fully liberated. The spokesman also said over 150 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured during the operation.
The Yemeni unit succeeded in fully liberating the districts of Mahliya and Al Rafa during the third phase of Al Nasr al Mubin operation. During the operation, 151 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured, and a total area of about 1,200 square kilometers were liberated.
Sariya also hailed the tribes of Marib for their role in supporting the Yemeni army in achieving the recent victory. Observers said the Yemeni army is now implementing the fourth phase of the Nasr al-Mubin operation, aimed at fully liberating all the occupied territories of Yemen.
The third phase of the Nasr al-Mubin operation was a strong and important stage for the Yemeni army. which managed to liberate 1,200 Yemeni lands from the mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition. Military operations are still ongoing, and there is a fourth phase through which the Yemeni army seeks to liberate all of the northern Yemeni lands from all forms of foreign presence.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations to liberate the Al-Richa province of Marib from the Saudi-backed forces and terrorist groups. This move was considered as the first step forward to expel foreign forces from the rest of the country.
Yemeni tribes have repeatedly announced their opposition to the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. People here believe that the military will not be able to liberate the country without the backing of tribesmen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip on Sunday titled The Resistance Liberates and Oslo Destroys. Attendees demanded the cancellation of the so-called Oslo Peace Accord that was signed in 1993. In September of that year, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, signed the Oslo Accord with the Israeli regime on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas asserted the failure of the Oslo Accord and affirmed its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime.
We assert that the shortest way to liberate all of Palestine and the prisoners is through the rifle and the resistance. Armed resistance is the one and only way to achieve the goals and aspirations of the Palestinian people.
The agreement was meant to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but years after signing the Oslo Accord, Palestinians consider it as a terrible chapter in their history.
The world must understand that the Israeli regime doesn't respect any international accords or agreements and only understands the language of force. The Oslo Accord has only brought pain and suffering and disasters to the Palestinians.
The conference comes almost 4 months after the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war.
The Oslo Accord caused the Palestinian rift, while the armed resistance has managed to achieve several victories against the Zionist enemy. The Palestinians are fully backing the resistance, especially after realizing that the Zionist enemy was the only one who benefited from the Oslo Accord.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Oslo Accord has been a major setback for Palestinians and is even worse than the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which helped create the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land.
Palestinian resistance factions say that the futile Oslo Accords will not free Palestine and Al-Quds. They maintain that armed resistance is the key to freedom. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
On Saturday, in the Italian capital, hundreds of people staged a protest against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass, which came into effect on August 6 and whose effects are set to be further extended. The Italian government is planning to make the so-called vaccine passport a requirement for employees at all public sector workplaces, as well as potentially at key businesses in the private sector, including supermarkets. At the rally, protesters were holding banners which read "United for Freedom of Choice" and "Hands off our children."
We are against all discriminations. People should be free to choose what's best for them, as stated in our constitution. Let me make clear that we are not against the vaccine.
Imposing a vaccine passport is nonsense. It's tantamount to blackmailing people. Furthermore, vaccines are still experimental and there are many unknowns about their effects.
The vaccine passport has been required since early August in order to access cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the health certification has become obligatory for long-distance trains, domestic air flights and schools amid widespread grumblings.
Free vax protests held across Italy over the past weeks have often turned nasty. A few days ago, the police staged